I'm real grateful to him. I love him a lot, and I know that y'all will too when you hear him. And with that, help me welcome Doug T. from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, everybody. My name's Doug Talbot, and I'm an alcoholic. I need a meeting, I tell you. Things do, don't change, but at least I'm here sober. And I do need a meeting tonight, and gosh, it gives me a good feeling to be back here. I spent a lot of time in the back of that room at tables several years ago, and had a lot of stuff going on recently, and been going to lots of meetings recently, and I'm so glad Lynn talked about sponsorship. I know I've got three sponsors, and I've talked to two of them today, and sponsorship's important to me. You know, the one thing that's sort of missing here is my better half. You see, she's a black belt Al-Anon, and as a black belt Al-Anon, she's at her church tonight. That's, I don't know the Al-Anon church, that's the Lady of Perpetual Revenge. She's there. See, I don't know whether you heard that story or not about the three people on death row, and they were all, they'd run out, everything had run out, and there wasn't anything left to do. They're all going to be electrocuted, and there were two alcoholics and an Al-Anon. So everything else finished. Time came to be electrocuted, and they pulled the first alcoholic up and sat him in the electric chair, and they said, "Do you have anything yet to say?" And he said, "Yes. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us." And the warden said, "Thank you very much," and threw the switch, and nothing happened. And the warden said, "My God, according to the state of laws of Georgia, I have to let you go." And he unstrapped him, and the alcoholic jumped up and ran out the door screaming all sorts of "one day at a time" and "easy does it," and brought the next alcoholic in and sat him down and said, "Do you have anything to say?" And he said, "Yes, I do. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understand him." And the warden said, "Thank you very much," and threw the switch, and nothing happened. And the warden looked at him and said, "My goodness," he said, "according to the laws of Georgia, I have to let you go." So he ran out, quoting one slogan of our slogans after another. So they went and they got the Al-Anon, and they put the Al-Anon in and said, "Do you have anything to say?" The Al-Anon looked around for a minute and said, "Yeah, you better plug that damn thing in if you really want it to work." I told that joke to Polly this morning. She didn't think it was one bit funny. Now, we kid our Al-Anons, and I'm not any different than a lot of folks in this room. I owe my life to my Al-Anon. If it wasn't for Polly, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to y'all tonight. She's just been the difference between me being alive and not being here, and I'm sorry she isn't here tonight. You know, they make it pretty easy for us, the big book, if we follow the rules to say how it was and what happened and how it is now. And I was born back in 1924 in Dayton, Ohio. I came from a real nice family, except my mother was alcoholic. And it's interesting, I'm a member, Martha didn't tell you, I'm a member of the CIA, I'm Catholic Irish alcoholic. And my mother's side of the family, she had six sisters and a brother, and her father died of alcoholism, six sisters died of alcoholism, and her brother died of alcoholism. And she was alcoholic, but of course I was never going to be an alcoholic, you know, I knew better. I graduated and it never did say G. Douglas Talbot, M.D., it said G. Douglas Talbot, M.D.T., and I knew daggone well God couldn't get alcoholism, so I wasn't going to ever be alcoholic. But I remember growing up, And I never had any trouble at home growing up with abuse, and we weren't a wealthy family, but we had plenty of money, and I always had everything I wanted except that things were empty. And I think that's the first time that I really got acquainted with that inner me. And that inner me was the would have been, could have been man. And ever since I grew up real early, I was a woulda been, coulda been. I always wanted to be a little bit more, a little bit something else, a little bit different, a little bit better. And I had a restlessness inside me and an inner restlessness that I never understood. And I always wanted to be a little more, wanted to be a little different, and I always wanted to be that would have been, could have been man. And I felt empty. And there was an emptiness in our house because Mother wasn't there a lot of the time, and I didn't know she was alcoholic when I was a youngster. In retrospect, it's perfectly clear to me. But I didn't really realize she was alcoholic as I was growing up. It was just an empty time in my life. And I went along with a childhood that wasn't that much different. I went to school. I did well in school just because I wasn't particularly bright, but I had a pretty good photographic memory, and I could memorize things. And so I went along school, and the only thing that I can remember, and a lot of this I can only remember in retrospect, I didn't drink very much. I didn't drink when anybody else drank because drinking scared me, and I never really knew in the beginning what drinking was about. And consequently, I didn't really have my first drink till I was about 16 years old. And it was an interesting experience, and I remember that drink because it was chemical magic, and I fell in love with the chemical the minute I had that drink. And suddenly, the would-have-been, could-have-been man sort of dwarfed, and I got happy with myself, and I wasn't so restless, and that inner restlessness disappeared, and I felt that I was a good person and could do lots of things, and I felt good with alcohol. But on the other hand, it scared me because I very quickly realized, even when I was drinking then, that I never drank for the occasion. If there was a party, I didn't drink for the party. I drank till I felt good. And feeling good was that the inner man was quiet and the would-have-been, could-have-been man was asleep. And that's why I drank. And I drank and it scared me. And so I didn't drink very much. And I went through school, and I got through school okay. I went through an incredibly short amount of time at college, and I went right into medical school, and I was very young. I was only 19 when I went to medical school. And I did well in medical school, and I never drank very much. And the only times that I drank, I can now remember that I never drank a little bit. I always drank for the feeling. I always drank to put the would-have-been, could-have-been man asleep. And I always drank to make that inner restlessness more quiet. And alcohol was a love affair for me. And yet it was a dangerous love affair. And I couldn't have ever voiced that. I would have never verbalized that to you. But I know in retrospect that I felt that way. I did well in medical school, and I went out to the University of California, and I spent a year out there as an intern. They had internships there. And then I spent 4 years of residency, and I was chief resident in medicine. I sort of went to the top in medicine, and I did well. And only, I know when everybody else partied, I didn't necessarily party with them. But when I partied, I always drank more than anybody else. First of all, my tolerance was very high. And secondly, I drank until the would-have-been, could-have-been man was quiet. Until that inner restlessness was asleep. And I felt good. But then I'd go home and I'd say, something's wrong. I better stay away from alcohol. And I went into the Air Force. I had 3 good years in the Air Force. I did well in the Air Force. And then I went into the space program. And in the space program, things changed a little bit because we had 42, I think, or 43 of the top pilots in the whole United States, and we had to pick 7. And boy, could those guys party. And I wanted to be part of them, so I used to party with them. And I used to drink some of them under the table. And we did a lot of partying then. And as I look back, I look back as those days with that heavy drinking when I passed the wall. Again, always drinking for the effect, always the would-have-been, could-have-been man there, always restless. No matter what I did as I look back, I don't remember ever being pleased with myself or satisfied with myself. I always remember saying, hey, you could have done better. You could get it. You could work. You could do this better. The only time I never said that to myself was when I drank. And when I drank, I felt good. I left the space agency and went into practice in Dayton, Ohio. And I went into the practice just at the turn of the 60s, in the late 1959 and 1960. And it was at that time that my disease really took off and began to really show itself, about 1962, 1963. And of course I started playing ping pong, chemical ping pong.
Were you drinking? No, I wasn't drinking. I hadn't had a drink in a month.
Of course, there was a lovely little pill called Meprobamate. It was called Milltown. And I used to gobble those down when I wasn't drinking. And then, of course, you know, you guys and gals in this room really missed something in the 60s because we physicians used to get all the medicine through the mail. They'd mail you amphetamines, mail you barbiturates, mail you everything. And I had six partners, and the postman would come, and you'd ring the bell and pass out the mail, and my partners would go to their office and read theirs, and I'd go to the eye office and eat mine. I loved it, you know, a little bit of that and a little bit of this. And then, of course, you know, those years, as I look back on it as my disease in Dayton when I was in practice progressed, I look back at sort of my ridiculous behavior. But, you know, I was no different than you guys. I can just see myself now explaining, you know,
I've got the dumbest wife in the whole United States. And the reason I drink is because of that dumb woman I'm married to. You know, I'm undressing, right?
She's looking at me, and she's saying, Doug, what are you doing with that Demerol syringe in your sock? Everybody of any note carries Demerol in their sock now. That's a status symbol. You don't carry that little black bag around anymore. No. Doug, you know, are you going to have a drink tonight? No. No, I'm not going to drink. You know, so she goes to the 7-Eleven or something and picks up the phone and dials me. All I say are five letters, H-E-L-L-O, hello. She says, you've been drinking. I slam the phone down, and then she's really pissed off because when she comes home, I've got the phone completely taken apart because I'm looking for the breathalyzer that she's hidden in. Nobody could know I was drinking if all I said was hello. Or the time that I felt that I could really make a major contribution in medicine, so I took the ice box apart because I was trying to freeze vodka into ice cubes. I didn't see any reason to waste the ice cubes in a vodka, so I was going to freeze vodka in ice cubes. And of course, it doesn't work very well, and I took the refrigerator apart, and I couldn't get it back. And, you know, the drinking went on, and like so many of us in this room, the drinking never did at that point get into my work, but it absolutely destroyed my family. And it's fascinating, you know, I was thinking, flying back on the plane tonight, about how I have effectively blocked out just whole periods of that time. And even tonight, there are things that bubble up to the surface that I haven't thought about for 15 years, the kind of pain that I invoked on my kids and on my wife. And it's extremely painful to even talk about it. And the way it sits way down deep. And maybe you guys or you gals in this room are a little different than I am, but I noticed through the years that as recovery comes and I share more in groups like this and share with my sponsors how some of those painful episodes lay buried way down deep. And I can remember my daughter, Wendy, calling the police and the terrible time that I had... when the police came, and she was terrified, and everybody, I don't know where everybody else was with that poor thing. I remember Doug, my son Doug Jr., having to serve in the surrogate role as the father and having to look after all of the kids, and the fights we used to have. I remember David leaving home, my son David leaving home. I remember flying out to San Francisco and getting drunk and ending up in a straitjacket, literally in a straitjacket in a hospital there. And I can remember so many of the painful things as time goes on about those memories come back. Some of them I'd give $1 million to take back. I'd give $1 million. And I was thinking about this driving out in the car. And my mother had a stroke. And I sat down by her bed, and she just couldn't speak. And I said, "Thanks a lot, Mom, for giving me alcoholism." And the tears rolled down her cheeks, because I was hot on the genetics at that point. And the tears rolled down her cheeks. And she died before I could ever make amends. I could ever go back and say, "Gee, Mom, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I really said that to you. I didn't mean it." And I couldn't really, really ever tell her I was sorry. And that hurts. And that's part of the pain of this doggone disease that you and I have got. If we could only take a minute back, if we could only take a moment and relive it and didn't do it. But that's why, you know, we've got the eighth and the ninth step, and that's why we've got prayer. Spirituality lets us communicate with those people that we really need to say I'm sorry to, and I've said I'm sorry to Mom now. But that's the kind of pain that this disease gave to me. My story isn't that different in the sense that the disease first destroyed my family. Gosh, I can remember Polly going down to hotels, motels, driving down, didn't know where she was going, checking in, and me going down trying to get her back to come back home. My kids in a turmoil. My job still protected, you know, that was isolated. There were walls out there. But I guess in many ways the worst thing was the pain inside of me. The would-have-been, could-have-been man just couldn't handle this. What was going on? I was doing everything I could possibly do. And finally, I got fired and things got so bad that after I was in Indianapolis and I had gone over there and drank myself into oblivion, they put me in another straitjacket and I tried to wrap a towel around my neck and kill myself. That I went back and home, still drinking. Nothing had worked. I took a geographic cure to San Francisco, and that didn't work. Polly had to come and get me. And so I went back home, still drinking, and my family, by this time, I had tried the shrink route. I had gone to the Menningers of the Midwest, a place in Columbus, Ohio, and I walked in there, and the psychiatrist said, "Don't worry about your drinking. Your drinking isn't the problem. It's an underlying psychiatric illness." And so I took one look at him and said, "Can I drink?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Great, I'm in here, you know. I'm lying me down on the couch, Mac." And boy, we lay down on the couch and we looked at everything. We looked at why I nursed on mother's left breast instead of her right breast, and why I like dogs, and why my father liked ponies, and we did everything, but I was still drinking all the whole time. I don't want to really sound bitter against that psychiatrist, because I really don't. I lay down on that couch and just had a marvelous analytical experience. And I want to tell you something. It was not all downhill. It wasn't bad, because from the time I lay down on that couch till I got off that couch broke and still drinking, But by the time I got off of that couch, that guy's marriage was so screwed up when I lay down there, and I was able to put it all back together again and get his kids back with him and him happy and his whole marriage all set together. Of course, I went broke, and I also bought him 5 Mercedes, but that didn't help any. And I went back out and was drinking, and then's when my family had no choice except to commit me through the courts to the state insane asylum. That's what it was back then in the 60s. And they put me on a big unit. I came in drunk, withdrawal, it was raining. And everybody has a bottom, and my pain is no worse than your pain, and my story is no worse or no better than your story. All our pains are relative, they're terrible. But that particular night I remember because it was bottom, and I was in the state insane asylum, and there were about 30 people there, and there was one attendant, and he laughed when I heard I was a physician, and they came within an inch of just beating the living bejesus out of me for about 6 hours. And I can remember ending up with them urinating on me and lying there with their urine and my blood and saying, I don't understand this. I've done everything I can humanly possibly do, and I'm still dying from drinking. And I don't know why I'm dying from drinking. And by this time, the would-have-been, could-have-been man was there all the time, saying, scumbag, no good, dummy, bad person, lousy father, terrible husband, you're drinking and you can't stop, you're just a no good bum and a no good scumbag. And the inner restlessness had crescendoed into the kind of pain that was unbearable. And I felt that I had failed everything and failed myself and failed my family and was a complete failure. And finally, my family came and got me out of there. I'd been there, I dried out, got out of there, and decided I would leave medicine, cardiology, internal medicine, and that I would try to find out about alcoholism because nobody knew what was wrong with me and nobody could help me. And, you know, we're talking now late 1960s. Talking 20 years ago, and not very much was known about alcoholism, but I decided to learn all I could. And I went up to the Institute of Addiction in Toronto, and I went to the Yale School of Alcoholism, I went to the Rutgers School, I went to the Maryland Institute, I went to every school I could lay my hands on and began to study alcoholism. And I was dry at this time, and this is where I learned the hard way about abstinence. And I went, Father DeCabot, God bless his soul, in that state hospital, came to me one day and he said, have you ever heard of AA? And I said, sure, Father, I've heard of AA. Wait a minute, I'll pull out my card here and I'll show you. It's right here. If you get a flat tire, you call them and they come and drag you into AA. He said, no, that's AAA. No, he said, I'm not talking about AAA, I'm talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't it fascinating? I mean, I was broke. I had been 22 months in a psychiatric institute lying on a couch. I was drinking. I had asked for all the help I could get from every doctor. Nobody had ever suggested AA. And Father DeCabot took me to AA and my first AA meeting. And in Dayton, Ohio, I started going to AA. And I don't know, like so many folks I know, I sure as heck went to AA for the wrong reasons, and I stayed for the right reasons. People ask me why I went to AA. It was the only place I could go. My medical society, when they would call up and ask about me, anybody, for any reason, they said I didn't exist. I was a non-entity in my town. And I can remember in that town of 750,000 people that I never saw a doctor in AA. I was the first doctor they'd ever had, I think, in AA in that town 20 years ago. And I went to AA simply because nobody else would let me go anyplace else. And the other thing is I couldn't figure you out. You talked about things that I didn't understand. I remember some awfully nice elderly lady coming up when I walked in an AA meeting and hugging me and said, I love you. And I said, how the heck can you love me when you don't even know me? And I didn't understand you. You seemed to be having a good time. You talked about love. You seemed to make me welcome. And I didn't understand why you would like me, why you would welcome me. because I sure as heck didn't like myself. And all I wanted to be was another person. If I could only be that would-be and could-be man, if I could just be somebody else, and the inner restlessness and the pain was there all the time, and as long as I was somebody else, I didn't want to be me. And I'd gone through all, of course, the alcohol. When I couldn't use alcohol, I used Demerol or Tolwyn or pills. When I couldn't drink and I would throw up, then I'd use every medicine I'd been in. And I was a full-blown alcoholic, drug addict, and chemically dependent in every sense of the word. And I started going to AA. And then I went back to Father DeCabot, and I said, Father DeCabot, there's got to be a soul, a person, a physician, somebody in the United States who's had this disease. I can't be the only doctor in the whole world who's had this disease. He said, well, I know of a physician over in Columbus, which was about 45 minutes away, and he said, why don't you go over and talk with him? So I went over to talk to Charlie H. and said, Charlie, I just want to get back in medicine. I haven't been in medicine now for 4 years. I'm a good doctor. I really think I am, but I'm just not a decent person. And I continued to be abstinent, and I continued to attend AA. Not participate, attend. I was a spectator. I was talking. Oh, I could tell you all the steps. I could mouth the words, but I was not participating. I wasn't part of the fellowship. One of the things I wasn't part of the fellowship was because, number one, I didn't trust you, because I didn't trust myself. And number one, I couldn't love you because I couldn't love myself. And I couldn't share with you. I didn't even know what sharing was. I didn't even know the meaning of the word. If you wanted to talk about sharing, I could talk about events or happenings, but there wasn't any way I could tell you how I felt. I couldn't tell you about my guilt, about my anger, about my depression, or about my low self-esteem. I didn't want you to know me, and I'd do anything to keep you away. I was the expert in telling you what your problems were. Boy, I could nail you across the room because it was a marvelous way of keeping you away from me. So you would never know me, and you could never get close to me. And I was terrified of you, because I felt if you ever knew me, you'd walk away from me, and you'd never come back and see me again. And so that was the state I was in. And I was going to schools. I did most of my AA up in Canada. I went to retreats. I went to AA in Maryland. I went to AA in Ohio. I went to lots of AA. And as I look back, I was abstinent, and I was a spectator, and I wasn't sober, and I hadn't gotten the program yet. About that time, though, the things began to change for the first time in my life, because there was a senator from Iowa named Harold Hughes. And he got a bill through Congress to start what's called the National Institute of Alcoholism, and for the NIH. And the first thing they did was to appropriate a lot of money for the most visible segment of the alcoholic population, Skid Row. And they heavily funded Baltimore, and they heavily funded Seattle, Washington, and Philadelphia. And Max Wiseman, who was the alcohol director down at Rutgers, I had been in his course, and then he'd asked me back there as a teaching assistant, and I was teaching at Rutgers, and he said, Doug, do you want to have the Skid Row program and be the medical director? I said, boy, a job? And he said, yeah. I said, how much does it pay? He said, $17,000 a year. I said, boy, that's great. I'll jump at it. I hadn't had a job for years, and $17,000 at that time was a fortune, as far as I was concerned. And so I did what everybody would do. I went down to Smithers, if you're a physician, and I read up on Skid Row. And, you know, I could tell you, I lecture for hours on Skid Row. And I read everything that was up to date, and Polly and the kids, we couldn't sell our house because we had mortgages on it. We didn't have any money left, and I went down and got an apartment. And I got the apartment, a one-room apartment at near Johns Hopkins, and I checked in with Reverend Hurt, who was the program coordinator, a minister down there, and I was there for 24 hours and realized everything I had read about Skid Row was malarkey. There wasn't any accuracy in it, at least in Baltimore. Baltimore is a very ethnic city. It has a Polish section, it has a white section, it has a black section. 6,000 Lumbee Indians live there in an enclave. An Italian section, it was very, very cut off in areas. And I walked in and I couldn't understand why 90% of Skid Row was white and lived in the black ghetto when there was a white ghetto. Why didn't they live in the white ghetto? Why did they live in the black ghetto? And then, of course, the other thing that really threw me as I got down there is I realized that only 50% of Skid Row drank and used drugs. 50% of Skid Row was completely abstinent. And that threw me. And so I checked myself out of the apartment. As far as myself is concerned, I kept the apartment to just store my stuff, and I went to live in Skid Row as a Skid Row alcoholic. And I wasn't that far from Skid Row. I was close in to Skid Row. And a marvelous thing happened to me. I found the most wonderful people in the world in many ways. The end of the road for you and me, but they were wonderful human beings. And something else happened to me. The would-have-been, could-have-been man started to go to sleep. Because for the first time in my life when I got down there, I found out I did not have anything to give those Skid Row people except me. And they didn't have anything to give me except them. And I found a wonderful group of human beings at the end of the road, which so many of us hope that we never have to go to. And I lived there, and there was tragedy, there was humor, there was danger, there was fun, there was Dandelion, who could, one of the great things that happened after I'd been there, after about 2.5 months I came out of Skid Row and started working, because I was the medical director of the Skid Row program. Doug came down and worked with me as an orderly there, and those were wild days. And I can remember all sorts of tremendous things happening. We had a church, and Maryland was the first state in the Union that agreed that alcoholics, there are a certain segment of the population which do not have the capacity to recover, and these people shall be treated as decent human beings and given food and shelter. So turning a church into a medical assessment center, we then turned a few of the tenements down there into halfway houses, and we brought them in. We had the shelter, and the shelter was where alcoholics could continue. They could continue to drink, not once they got in the door, and we housed them. We took the alcohol away from them, and then the anchor, if they were sober for a month, they went to the anchor, and then if they were sober there 2 months, they went to what we euphemistically call the Waldorf. And that was our therapeutic community, and I began to work down there with them. I can had so many marvelous things happen to me. Those of you in the past remember when I've shared about marvelous little Michael. Michael came up to my chest. He was always drunk. I guess I related to him because he too was Irish with a Scottish background. And I remember sitting up all night with Michael one night when he went through the DTs, and I finally got him through the DTs, and I had a cot there. I went and lay down on the cot, and the nurse came and said, "Michael's leaving." And Michael always had a black bowler hat. And I grabbed him and I said, "Michael, you little SOB, you're going to die if you get out there." And I can still see him. He came right up to my chest and he had a little white hair sort of scraggled up. He was always dirty and, of course, smelled of alcohol. And he took his little bowler hat and he rammed it down on his head and he says, "Look." He says, "There are a hell of a lot more old drunks than old doctors around." And walked out the door. And that's what he did with my tremendous advice. And of course Michael was always marvelous, and the great thing to me about Michael was that we were just up the street from Johns Hopkins, and Johns Hopkins, of course, still has the hallowed halls that Osler and the great surgeons of the past walk in. So one day they brought Michael in, and Michael was drunk and had fallen down and slid his head. So I told the guys, I said, Doug may have been one of them, but anyway, I said, "Take Michael up to the emergency room and get him sewed up." So I was there, it was the end of a long day, and I was tired, and the phone rang, and this very English voice said, "Dr. Talbot?" I said, "Yes." I said, "Discharge Nurse Richardson, Johns Hopkins."
congratulations, George, Nurse Richardson. What are you in charge of? She said, I am in charge of the emergency room. She said, is Michael O'Shaughnessy your patient? I said, yes. I said that he has a laceration of his skull, and I sent him up there. She said, Dr. Talbot, we cannot sew that laceration on Mr. O'Shaughnessy. I said, charge, Nurse Richardson, are you not an emergency room? She said, yes. I said, why can't you sew the laceration? She said, Mr. O'Shaughnessy has not had a bath. I said, charge, Nurse Richardson, Mr. O'Shaughnessy has not had a bath in about 2.5 years. And I would think that he will not have a bath for... That charge, Nurse Richardson said, I cannot sew his head up. I... And with that, it was the most blood-curdling scream I ever heard. I said, oh, my God, he stabbed her. Or if he has, I hope it's in a vital place. All of a sudden, this terrified English voice comes over the phone. Dr. Talbot, Mr. O'Shaughnessy is urinating on me. I said, where is he urinating? On my leg! I said, why don't you move your leg? And we gave Mr. O'Shaughnessy a party when he came back. And we had a lot of other... I could spend, as I remember, thinking about those days there of all the tragedy and the fun and the things I was learning. Anybody got any trouble with humility? I can give you a little lesson in humility. I used to look for my alcoholics at night. And Skid Row, as you know, is deliberately in every big city, beside the gambling joints, the brothels, the house of prostitutions, the seedy side of the city. And one segment that I had gotten to know very well when I was living in Skid Row, when I was sleeping in the bridges, under the bridges, and in the abandoned cars, and in the tenements, was I'd gotten to know the transvestites. And the transvestites are a very interesting group of people by themselves. And they stay by themselves as opposed to people who are hooking or prostitutes. All of these people were marvelous people and friends of mine. But the transvestites were off by themselves. They always were. And one night it was raining and cold and I was out and I always knew where the transvestites hung out. It was at the Pink Hippopotamus. So I walked in the Pink Hippopotamus about 1 o'clock in the morning and there they were, about four of them or five of them, and I sat down and of course I knew them and they knew me and we just were drinking coffee and I don't know what they were drinking, I was drinking coffee and we were talking, chit-chatting, and all of a sudden I went up and I went to the restroom and we'd been having a lot of fun and laughing. And when I came back, you could have cut the air with a knife. And it was just absolutely something terrible had happened, and you just could feel the tension and feel just you could have almost grabbed the air. And I said, hey, what happened? Look what happened when I was just here and everybody was laughing and having fun. And one of them turned to me, and the others actually had tears in their eyes, and the tears were rolling down her cheeks. And they said, we were talking, and we can't think of anything more pitiful than a doctor being so drunk that he has to end up living in Skid Row. And, you know, all I could think of was even Kitty from the transvestite group. And this is the way my life is ended. And I'd like to tell you that all that AA and everything was beautiful and I was sober. I wasn't. I was abstinent. They had a strike in Skid Row. And it was the police went out on strike and the street, which I knew well, came and told me that they were going to hit our place for the drugs. So I stayed up all night, a couple of nights, with a shotgun. And then, of course, I listened to that great medical mentor of all times, Lawrence Welk. He said it was okay. So I took a little Sominex, and guess what? You know, about 3 weeks from 2 weeks, I've forgotten, very short time from Sominex, I had my first drink. And, of course, the one thing I had learned from you, and I had learned in my reading and in my talking and in my teaching at Johns Hopkins, was I was in trouble. And that's why my life in many ways is BC and AC, because there was a wonderful guy named Dick Caron at Wernersville, Pennsylvania, and had a place called Chit Chat Farms. And I went and I spent 28 days at Chit Chat Farms, and that was the beginning of my recovery. Because when I went there, Dick took one look at me and said, "When are you going to start in AA?" I said, "Dick, for God's sakes, I've been to 200 or 300 or 400 AA meetings." He said, "You've never been a part of AA." He said, "Now just take the cotton out of your out of your ears and shove it in your mouth and shut up." And he said, "I don't want you to do anything but work with the first three steps. Forget all the other steps. Just you work for the first three steps, and that's what."
Fast forward, please, to the end of the tape. Turn your...
start. And I did begin my recovery in February 19th, 1974, although I'd had almost 3 years of abstinence before that. My recovery started after my relapse. And in February 19, 1974, I started to get well. And I began to recover slowly in the real fellowship of AA. And I did, other thing Dick told me was never allowed me to talk. He said, you can enter into a discussion meeting, but you may never talk in an AA meeting for 2 years. And he said, you're at high risk. And I am at high risk. I'll tell you, I'll share something with you that 4 years ago I quit talking at any AA meetings because I gave a talk at an AA meeting and somebody came up who was very sincere, very honest, and he was trying to be nice. But he and two other people came up and said, "I thank you for that interesting lecture." And that's tough because I've been lecturing all afternoon to the National Medical Society. And it's very difficult to be honest and use these because for me, this is two things. It's a celebration of Tom and Martha and whoever else's birthday it is, but it's a tenth step for me. It's a chance to continue to take personal inventory and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it and try to begin to really look at my recovery in the way that recoveries need to be looked at. I'm happy now because I'm doing something that is very, very important to me, and it goes back to a room with cells and bars and urine and blood. And it goes back to when I was lying there in the state hospital, I said, if I ever begin to recover, I'm going to try to find a place for the doctors to go, for physicians to begin to recover, for the healers to begin to get healed. And I've been part of that movement, and with nurses and pharmacists and dentists, and I've learned from you tremendously, and we're trying to help other people too. And but you know, the best way to give our sobriety what little we have is to try to give it away. And the time has gone on since I left Chit Chat in the last 74. My grant at the NIH ran out. I left Skid Row. The day I left Skid Row, I got the greatest gift that any human being has ever gotten. The greatest gift that any physician has ever gotten in his whole life. And the night I left, it was raining and cold, and little Michael was lying there shivering, still drinking. And I said, "Michael, I came to say goodbye." And he said, "Dinner go, Doc." I said, "I've got to go, Michael." And he said, "Dinner go, Doc." And I said, "I have to go, Michael. It's time to go." And he said, "Do me a favor, Doc." And I said, "Sure, Michael. What is it?" And he reached up, and that little old, dirty, drunken man put his arms around me and kissed me. And he says, "Doc, I just want you to know that I like me better when I'm with you." And that's the greatest gift for a patient to say that he likes himself better when he's with you. It was the greatest gift I've ever received. In all my years of medicine, more precious than all the gold and silver and jewels of any place I know. And Michael let me begin to see myself again. And it was in that time, for the first time, that the would-have-been, could-have-been man began to disappear. And I began to be okay with myself, really for the first time in my life. And the inner restlessness, the inner storm began to disappear. And I began to like me again. And the thing that has brought me to growth and maturation and above all, love has been AA in rooms like this, and my sponsors and people like you who have loved me back to loving myself. I didn't know what love was. I didn't even know how to love my wife. I thought love for her was crawling in bed and having sex with her and sharing things with her, but I couldn't share really myself. And we have an incredible life now. Just the most marvelous life of all times. I had sex last night with Polly, and it's an entirely different kind of sex. It's nifty. You've got to watch these white hairs, guys. There's hope for you yet. I have a whole new relationship with people. And, you know, the greatest thing that I've learned from you, I think you've done really three things for me. You've gotten rid of the would-have-been, could-have-been man. That's gone. I'm okay with me now, just as I am. I got a long ways to go. I got lots of recovery to do, but I'm okay inside, and the inner peace is there. It's not an inner storm, an inner restlessness. That's left. And I found that in AA club rooms, and I found that in AA meetings. I've been to lots of meetings this past 3 weeks. I've needed them, and I've taken a lot of time with my sponsors. I've needed them. And I've needed you. But you know, the biggest and the most tremendous gift you've given me, Michael gave it to me, and you gave it to me, is you have taught me. I haven't learned yet. I'm just learning still. But you've taught me how to love. I did not know what love was. When that woman kissed me, when I first came into AA and said, I love you, she was saying something that I couldn't understand. I have a big poster in my office, and it shows a swan floating along with a little signet, a little baby swan, and it says, true love is when nothing is expected in return. That was new to me. I couldn't relate to you except how you could give me something back, either physical or emotional or money or something. And I couldn't love you just to love you. And one of the things that I learned that was so amazing to me when you taught me love was I didn't have to be uncomfortable around you anymore. I didn't have to be anybody but me. I didn't have to be the would-have-been, could-have-been man. I know a lot of you in this room, and I love you. I don't know a lot in this room, but there isn't anybody I don't, in another way, love at a different level. There isn't anybody in this room that I dislike. But the important thing is not, don't have to worry anymore the way you feel about me. I hope you like me, but that isn't important. The important thing is I love you, and I don't need anything from you. I don't expect anything from you, and I don't want anything from you, except one thing. I want to be with you. I want to love you like AA has taught me that you love me. Before my flat in the liquor store tonight, Roger Whittaker was singing, and I remember the words, and I love you, and I love you more than words can tell.